Welcome to the San Diego Psychological Association's podcast, Diving into Healing. I'm your host, Dr. Michelle Carcel. This podcast has been developed with the intent to inform and educate the general public and providers and should not be relied upon for any other purpose. The content, views, and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speaker and not those of the San Diego Psychological Association. We're excited to be talking about the topic of OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. I'd like to welcome our guest, Dr. William Taboas. Thank you for being on our show.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
Great. Before we begin, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became interested in anxiety disorders, but specifically OCD.
Sure. I became interested in anxiety. It's a kind of a long story because it became a happy accident. My background was conducting research, did my bachelor's in Puerto Rico, where I was born and raised. And we were looking at adapting cognitive behavioral therapy for Latino families. And the major themes were depression and anxiety. And over the course of my graduate school, going in the trajectory of mood disorders. But over the time I started learning about anxiety disorders, and specifically I stumbled upon in grad school a lab that focused on treating anxiety disorders, and I fell in love with the idea of doing exposure therapy. And that kind of blew my mind about how therapy is not just about sitting in a room in a couch and talking, but you can do many things with a client and see results right in front of you. And the idea of that was very appealing, rewarding. And over time, as I got to understand and treat OCD and see the results, and also got curious about why people get OCD and how treatment works, when people get the right treatment, is life-changing. So that piece is also very rewarding. So that's, long story short, how I got into anxiety disorders and specifically OCD.
Oh, that's wonderful. I completely agree with you. I think the misconception a lot of times is that, you know, therapy is kind of what you see on TV. You know, the therapist sitting across, you're sitting in, you know, right there having a conversation, the client's on a couch, and, you know, it's more talk therapy. But, you know, when it comes to exposure treatments, it really is a more active form of treatment. So I think I completely agree with you. I think that's great. And, you know, now that we're just kind of diving into obsessive compulsive disorder, I think it'd be good to define it a little bit, especially for those who are not as familiar with this disorder. I find that we talk about anxiety a lot, but we don't specifically talk about OCD. So I think it might be good to have us talk about what is OCD and what isn't OCD.
Got it. Yeah, sure. I'm going to start maybe with the clinical definition, and then maybe we can talk a little bit about what people call OCD outside of clinical settings, and maybe dispel some things associated with that. So specifically, if we're going to reference in the United States, we use the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Psychiatric Disorders. Internationally, we also use the ICD-10, and some mental health settings will use it as well. So the key features are what we call pathognomic features, or the presence of obsessions and compulsions. You need both. I hear a lot of people saying, well, I have one or the other. But the essential feature is that you need the presence of intrusive thoughts. These intrusive thoughts feel very distressing, might create anxiety, and in some cases might create other emotions such as anger, fear, disgust, shame, and guilt. Historically, they're known and they're part of the anxiety disorder family, but we'll get into the other emotions later. And compulsions. And compulsions are actions used to neutralize or undo the obsessions, or maybe allay the distressing emotions and sensations associated with the intrusive thoughts. They both have to exist. The interesting part about OCD, as that I learned early on, is that we all engage in some sort of pattern where there are some intrusive thoughts. And in fact, there's plenty of research showing that intrusive thinking or intrusive thoughts or images or sensations are fairly common in the general public, but most people tend to dismiss the thoughts. They don't stick. Some people just say, oh, that's a weird thought, and they just go on with their day. But for some people, it creates a lot of genuine and sincere distress. It just creates so much distress that people try to control their thoughts, but in the efforts to control, they just create a cycle of making the thought more powerful. So the other key feature is that people need to spend a lot of time in them. So some people might get the intrusive thought about, oh, maybe I'm contaminated, I should wash. And you get done in 20 to 30 seconds of washing. But for some people, it's hours and hours and hours throughout the day. Sometimes not in the same time. Sometimes it accumulates to that. That leads to functional impairments, which is the other diagnostic key feature. And functional impairment can look very different to many different people. So imagine that you're washing so much that your hands start getting raw. You are undoing or checking certain things, or checking the house, the stoves, the locks, the car keys, that you're getting late to work. Or maybe you cannot even get work because you're late to job interviews and et cetera. So depending on your cluster of symptoms, the themes, your functional impairment might wrap around those themes, and it can be very impairing. They need to be time consuming, and they need to create significant functional impairment and distress.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. You know, as you were speaking, I was thinking a little bit about the movie As Good As It Gets. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but yeah. I guess you would call it a classic. You have, you're familiar. You know, this film, you know, and films like it portray, Jack Nicholson was phenomenal, well-deserved Oscar. You see the struggle. You see how this impaired his relationships, you know, how difficult it was for him to actually engage with others. And, you know, I think it's important that we talk about the level of severity of this particular disorder and how it can be debilitating. Can you give us some examples just from a clinical standpoint and for the general population?
So sure. So think. So that's a great movie, great reference. I'll dovetail maybe the topic of interpersonal relationships, since that was one of the key themes in that movie, which is the person's life becomes wrapped around the obsessions and compulsions to the point where engaging in meaningful social interactions becomes difficult. And like I mentioned before, the themes of the obsessions and compulsions might dictate what that impairment looks like. In that specific movie, if I recall correctly, there were some check-in rituals and also some contamination washing rituals. They were both time-consuming but also life-constraining, to the point where someone from outside Jack Nicholson's bubble, that his character, had a hard time wedging in and kind of interacting. And he would also put up limitations to his life because of that. So that's an example. Another example would be, let's say someone has harming obsessions about intrusive thoughts about harming self or others. Part of the OCD cycle, it might be also to avoid things all completely that might trigger those really distressing thoughts. So people just avoid social interactions altogether. People avoid certain parts of the house or certain places in the world. So life becomes very, very constrained. And some severe situations, let's say for contamination reasons, disgust reasons, or whatnot, some people maybe stop taking care of themselves altogether, stop eating because they're afraid of certain contaminants, for example, stop bathing because they fear there might be some contaminants in the water or the water supply. Functional impairment can look very different to different people, but the core issue that I'm trying to get at is that life looks very limited, very constrained.
Mm-hmm. Very constrained. And it's important that we address that and how, you know, people who are suffering from this, you know, they're not alone, and that there are ways that we can help. And I think it's important for us to talk a little bit about, you know, how people can seek treatment for this and how do we treat OCD? Can you speak to that?
Sure. So the good news about OCD is that there are resources for people. And by resources, I mean organizations like the SDPA and the International OCD Foundation that can refer both the public, people that are suffering from OCD, or clinicians that might need support in treating OCD. So there are places that will direct you to seek the right treatment. Another good news is that there is a gold standard treatment that has been established for the last 50 to 60 years, which is exposure and response prevention. And there's also a number of clinical trials proving that some medications work. So we have exposure and response prevention, which is the gold standard. We also have variations of cognitive behavioral therapy that might work, that might include an exposure and response prevention component. And in some cases, we would combine that with medication. So there are multiple avenues to treat OCD.
Yes, that's so true and so wonderful that we have this research that supports these interventions that can really help people with this debilitating disorder. You know, as we're talking about some of these, I think it might help, you know, I'm familiar, of course, with exposure treatment, but can you talk a little bit about exposure and response prevention for the general public?
Sure thing. So this is why I got into OCD in the first place. It sounds intimidating and scary at first, but once you get into actually doing exposure with a client, it becomes very dynamic. Let me start with maybe explaining the model behind exposure and response prevention and why we expose ourselves to the fear. That will be the theme of exposure therapy. But the key here is also the response prevention piece to interrupt the cycle. So to my latter point, people with across anxiety disorders and including OCD, I'm of the opinion that aligns closer to anxiety disorders. People engage in safety behaviors. Anxiety is a powerful signal to self-preserve, to self-protect, and to anticipate problems in the future. But in some cases, these become false positives. That's the issue with a lot of these disorders. And for OCD, we engage in these safety behaviors to allay the distress associated with the obsessions and compulsions. These behaviors can be overt avoidance, in some cases, internal or mental avoidance, or maybe some neutralizing of thoughts. So there are cases that people say, well, I have these obsessions, and I'm not sure if I have OCD because I don't have any overt compulsions. The first step I want to ask, are you engaging in any mental rituals, anything internal? Because that can also be a form of avoidance and a form of engaging in compulsions. So assessing safety behaviors like avoidance, reassurance seeking, actively trying to suppress the thought. Thought suppression is another word. And then their general clinician might relate to general self-soothing behaviors or self-medicating behaviors such as drug use, alcohol use, and things like that. And the issue with engaging in these safety-seeking behaviors is that people feel a relief in the moment, but it also reinforces the notion that you need them to address the obsession, and in turn reinforces the obsession itself. So the classic example I use is, okay, you have try not to think of a white elephant, and the more and more you try not to think it, you're still invoking the thought. So think of very distressing thoughts you're trying to suppress, but the more you actively try to suppress, you're trying to invoke it, or if you need to think that you have to avoid something, you still have to think about the distress. So the thing that we're trying to do is make sure that we stop the cycle by assessing these safety behaviors. Then there's the classic CBT model where you get a situation, a trigger, automatic thoughts or beliefs. These lead to emotions and then the safety-seeking behaviors, and the cycle goes on and on. So the idea of exposure and response prevention is to interrupt the cycle and think of it as the person acquired the behavior through a biological predisposition combined with some individual or psychological factors, and maybe in some things in the environment kind of contributed to that or the person's rearing. So we call that the biopsychosocial model. And so we're trying to interrupt that negative reinforcement cycle by exposing ourselves to the fear situation and also preventing, keyword, response prevention from engaging in compulsions. And this is key. We want to make sure that the person learns something from it. Interrupting this cycle to introduce a new learned experience, a corrective experience, which is a common term in therapy, a corrective experience where the person learns a new association with the trigger. That's the best way I can summarize it.
No, that's great. Actually, I was just thinking, as you were saying this, to kind of put it out there in a general sense and in lay terms, going back to the movie, you know, thinking a little bit, it just is such a good example. It just kind of sticks to my head, you know, where initially he was, you know, very, he was having these compulsions to not walk over the cracks in the sidewalk, you know, that was where he had to do this maneuver as the compulsion to control how he was, those intrusive thoughts. But as he was able to do the exposure by having that interpersonal relationship, by having that romantic relationship with actress Helen Hunt's character, we see that he's able to do it. And that's kind of, that, you know, I realize that's a very simple example, but I think just to keep it simple, that is in essence what we're trying to do with this form of treatment, you know, facing the anxiety, facing the fear, but doing it in a healthy, adaptive way versus maladaptive. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I totally agree. actually, since you mentioned the movie, one of the things that we want to tap into is why do people want to expose themselves into the fear in the first place? So we want to, when we do the initial sessions, we're not just doing assessment and kind of tallying the number of obsessions and compulsions and the safety behaviors. We also want to get a sense of if OCD wasn't a problem, what kind of life would that look like? So we want to tap into those life goals, those values, and what a life worth living looks like for people, because this is not an easy treatment. So we want people to become very motivated to face their fears for a reason, not just to white knuckle through it. We want to make sure that they're always anchored to their goals.
Absolutely. Yes. You know, and on that note, are there any common misconceptions about treatment for OCD?
There are plenty. So the first one I want to dispel is that we're not tossing you to the deep end. All kinds of exposure therapy, including ERP, exposure and response prevention, or in some cases EXRP, depending on the book, you do things in a step way where we would start someplace easy for you. And as you develop momentum, as you develop confidence, we start moving things up. You essentially make a scale 0 to 100, 0 to 10, and you put things on the low end. You have concerns about blasphemy, for example, religious obsessions and praying compulsions or compensatory behavior. Maybe in 100 in the hierarchy would be, you know, cursing God, for example, or maybe even doing things worse, like drawing pentagrams or like invoking the devil and things like that. But lower than that, you might say not even a curse word. You might say, oh, shoot, instead of the curse word, or something along the lines of, oh, my goodness, instead of, oh, my God. And so this is a creativity part and the collaboration piece that takes place between the clinician and the client. Where is our wedge in to start building that confidence and momentum, and you slowly inch towards the dream thoughts? That's the first thing I want to dispel, that it's you're going to be suffering through the whole thing. It will get uncomfortable. The intention is always to develop that confidence. So on the clinician side, there's kind of a flip side. There's good research to show that a lot of clinicians either maybe they haven't heard of exposure and response prevention, or maybe they just don't know the research behind it, or maybe they just don't believe in it. They think that they're doing harm to the client. So let me address the first comment first about doing harm to the client. The key feature of the way that every ERP training I've been to, or every ERP clinician I've spoken to, is that this treatment is compassionate treatment. It's always in the service of getting them well. If you're not giving them the right medication or the right treatment, in some cases, you might do harm. So in this case, we're implementing a treatment that has shown good empirical support for decades. So this is very compassionate treatment. And also, you collaborate so much with a client that in the moments you start doing exposure and response prevention, you've developed good therapeutic alliance and good rapport. The hope is that that builds onto itself and into the exposure hierarchy.
This methodology and this process, yes, is definitely compassionate and also has a lot of evidence-based research behind it. So that is very important for clinicians to be aware, and for clients and for people listening, you know, if you are suffering from this, to know that I agree, you know, I'm familiar with exposure work, and it sounds scary, but I kind of want to say this too, that, you know, from pain comes growth, right? And it sounds like such a cliche, but, you know, we are all trying to work towards, you know, goals in some way or form. And whether it's you're, you know, trying to, you know, be healthier and, you know, take care of yourself better, you know, that means you're going to have to change some behaviors, right? And, you know, as I'm hearing you speak about this, I think it's good to remind both people who are suffering from this debilitating disorder and for clinicians alike that, you know, this is a, there are ways to manage this and a systematic way to approach it from a clinical perspective.
Right. You just reminded me of the second point. Thank you. The exposure sessions or exposure response sessions, you always want to create that corrective experience that comes from facing difficult emotions that is no different than any other treatment, psychological treatment that you do. You have to almost always face very difficult emotions. This falls in line with that. There are other misconceptions, but those are kind of like the main ones, the ones that either makes a clinician hesitant to implement or makes a patient or a client hesitant to seek out help. The other one that's more of a practical one, you can do exposure many different ways. You can do exposure in vivo with the actual objects. In some cases, you might do exposure imaginally with thoughts and scripts. It's the bodily sensations that some people fear. So you might do exposure to bodily sensations. Again, the idea is we start where you're ready to start. We might encourage you, push you here and there the same way we would push with any other sort of treatment. We want our clients to walk out with a little bit more wind under their wings, so to speak, in terms of motivation and seeing that they can actually face their fears.
Absolutely.
Without the help of compulsions.
That is the key. Yes. You know, again, changing any maladaptive behavior to one that is healthy and functional is the key to pretty much treatment in general. I'm actually encouraged because, you know, particularly with the gold standard that you're describing, you know, yes, it may be a little bit difficult, but the fact is that since we have this and it's been tried and true and proven to be functional and it works well, a lot of people come out feeling so much better than, you know, when they started and having to deal with this particular disorder. So I actually, as we were talking, I was thinking, you know, you mentioned Puerto Rico. So I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about any cultural considerations that might be helpful for, you know, some listeners that come from different backgrounds. Any information there? I realize I'm kind of just asking this in a general sense, and it's a pretty broad question, but you know, is there any cultural considerations for OCD, things that might be helpful for, you know, people of different backgrounds, different ethnicities, you know, families as well?
Yes. So let me make a mental note about specifically cultural backgrounds. And also, I also want to address religious backgrounds, because a lot of the themes are things that we find really important in our lives, our family, culture, religion, things that bring a lot of meaning. That is very individual to what the client presents. I'll give an example for religion, and then maybe I'll give an example for, let's say, people from different ethnic and cultural backgrounds. Examples of religion. I was raised Catholic, so I'm very familiar with sin, for example, that I can lean into a client that's presenting with religious themes in their OCD with a Catholic flavor. However, when I've worked with clients from Jewish backgrounds, once we worked with a client with their background was Zoroastrian, I wasn't terribly familiar. So there needs to be a lot of collaboration, understanding, and some fundamentals about the religion that I might not know myself. The key issue is always the OCD tricks you into thinking that the extra thing that you're doing that is in line with your religious values fundamentally necessary for you to be a true believer. So it creates a cycle of doubting around your own beliefs and your own behaviors. And in some cases, if you're not familiar with a religion, not just where the client's coming from, but maybe a background of that religion. So what's common to do is you might seek out a consultation with clergy, for example, or religious figures, people from the community, to kind of get an understanding of where the religion stops and the OCD starts. So kind of teasing those apart. A lot of people with OCD will report tremendous insight of where the religion stops and the OCD starts. They kind of know themselves that, yeah, this is where I start feeling the anxiety or feeling the distress. And maybe that's a workable piece a clinician can do. But yes, so definitely have that awareness that even within, let's say, my own familiar religion of Catholicism, there's great variation in expression across countries, which brings me to the cultural piece. There are sometimes OCD manifests itself in themes regarding to, let's say, child care, family care. And there might be some, in some cases, family accommodation where the family dynamics are such that it's okay for people to intervene in your OCD culturally because, like, they might want to facilitate things in the household. So those are all the considerations where a clinician might want to do a thorough assessment of what the life at home is to make sure that we still want to interrupt the cycle with family buy-in. There are some situations where family accommodation needs to be addressed with the people in the family. So that is very individual, and not every culture is a monolith. So even within the culture, there's variation or degrees to that. So yes, so leave assumptions aside. treat their patient like a new person. That I think that's supposed to be self-evident, but you know, we're humans and sometimes we make mistakes. And also try to get a sense of people's backgrounds and beliefs, specifically beliefs and values within their culture that might be important for you to address.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I think it's important that we're constantly reminded of cultural components when it comes to any form of, you know, assessment or, you know, where it's talking to somebody, to always keep that in mind. So I'm glad you're bringing that to the forefront as well. And we're talking about clinicians and practical information for clinicians, but I want to switch gears for a second and, you know, address, you know, people who are not familiar and do not have clinical backgrounds, who are not psychologists, psychiatrists. What can they do and what can family members do? Actually, we'll reference family. What can family members who are listening, who might have someone who has a diagnosis of OCD, what can they do to help?
Great question. So we want to have a little bit of do's and don'ts. So do try to listen and try to understand the OCD. And you can do this in many different ways. You know, basic empathy goes a long way. But you can also support in many different ways, seeking out information, listening to this wonderful podcast is another example, buying books. The internet can be another great resource for you to kind of learn about what's going on. Because from someone who doesn't suffer from OCD, the compulsions, obsessions don't make any sense. That's the most frustrating part I hear from family and family support groups, or when I consult with family members, is that I just don't understand. Help me understand. And the thing is, the obsessions feel so real to the person with OCD. A person without it, it's just another world. It's just another reality. Making attempts to understand OCD goes a long way in creating that empathy. And so, yeah, do your homework, read about it, seek professional consultation. In some cases, the patient themselves or the person with OCD is not ready to seek treatment. Maybe the family members need a little bit of support and consultation and support groups. That's another big resource for family members. There are some support groups specific for family members, not just patients. Try your best not to invalidate because you don't understand the logic behind it. Saying statements like it's all in your head might be true, might not be true, but it's not terribly helpful. Try not to treat it yourself without the support of a clinician. In fact, the idea behind doing ERP is for the patient to engage things and develop that self-efficacy and independence. But if you're specifically trying to address family accommodation, yeah, definitely like consult with a clinician on how to either cut it out altogether or in a scaffolding kind of way, stop with the accommodation. I don't think I never got to define what family accommodation looks like, but essentially when you're inadvertently or on purpose engaging on the compulsions because you're seeing so much distress in the other person, so you're just, you know, participating in a compulsion with them.
Yeah, that's very good that you bring that up. I think those suggestions are absolute, right? The necessities for people to get that information, to have that support for themselves, but also for the family member that they're, you know, concerned about. There are resources out there and that were available to help in that way. You know, for the person who is listening, who has been suffering from OCD, who maybe has not reached out to a therapist yet, or who is, you know, trying to figure this out for themselves and struggling with this, what resources do you want to reference that could be helpful for them?
Sure. So the big one is the International OCD Foundation. It has many great links and resources, anything from self-help guides to books, to workshops, to links to find therapists that specialize in OCD. The IOCDF would be one. The Association for Behavioral and Cognitive Therapies, ABCT, is another big one that has the same type of resources. The Anxiety and Depression Association of America, ADAA. So those are the major ones that have specific resources for people with OCD.
Great. Thank you for that. And for any therapist listening, what can they do to further their training?
Sure thing. So the same websites and the same associations, IOCDF, ABCT, and the ADAA have resources for clinicians, workshops, links, CE credits. Those are fantastic resources. The IOCDF also is associated with the Behavior Therapy and Training Institute that offers specific workshops for exposure response prevention, another fantastic one. So it's also common for people to go to a lot of trainings and workshops but never see a person with OCD. And that is very difficult if you live in an area that's hard to find exposure, so to speak. to that population. Consult, seek supervision from an expert. This is also common. So getting that peer supervision, peer support is another way to train. And there are specific hospitals or locations that have worked with OCD. So in the San Diego area, we have Rogers Memorial Hospital. Also, Sharp Mesa Vista, it might be a good resource. Reach out to the local hospitals that they have departments dedicated for these resources.
Perfect. I am so happy you were here, Dr. DeBoeth. This has been wonderful. I'm very excited to have listeners get this information, whether you're a clinician or someone who is a family member of someone with OCD or a person who is suffering from OCD. We hope this information helps you. And thank you again so much for being on today.
Thank you for having me.
The information and advice offered is not intended to treat or diagnose and is not meant to replace any other professional consultation. If you'd like to know more about the San Diego Psychological Association, go to our website at sdpsych.org. That's sdpsych.org. Thank you so much for tuning in. Until next time, take care of yourself and be well.